with a word of prayer. Father, I ask as we look to your word this morning, we always pray that your Holy Spirit would use your word and the things that are shared to search our hearts and our minds, that our greatest desire, Lord, is to be made conformable to your will, to bring our lives into that perfect alignment with your will for our lives, that we might experience not only the fruitfulness and the effectiveness of being in that right relationship with you, but also that we would know the joy that comes with seeing you exalted and you lifted up in the world around us. Help us, Father, overcome our infirmities and weaknesses. Speak to us. You said that faith comes by hearing and hearing by the word of God. Help us to grow in faith because we have heard your word. In Jesus' name, amen. The book of Revelation, where we begin our reading today, is probably the least read, the most infrequently taught, and in many ways for most Christians, most neglected book of the Bible. That even Christians who might take the time to read it often read it rather quickly and cursively because they feel like it's impossible to understand. And that's a reasonable conclusion. In fact, when I was meditating on the book of Revelation the other day, it reminded me of something that Winston Churchill once said about the country of Russia. He said, "Russia is a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside of an enigma." And that's certainly true because Revelation can feel like it's really kind of so abstract because of the form of symbolism that was very common in the ancient world, but is not so common today. We live in a very linear, straightforward, and direct way of communicating today. We're told that if you want to communicate, do it simply so that people can easily follow along. But in the ancient world, where language was considered an art, something to be experienced, in fact, even as early as the 19th and early 20th century, people would come into a setting like this, and if the message was any less than 2.5 hours long, they felt like they had been cheated. I remember reading John Quincy Adams, our third president, was complaining because he had invited a pastor to speak at the rotunda in the Congress. They used to have church service in the Congress, the State House in Washington, D.C., right there. If you've ever been there, the big rotunda there, they'd hold church services every Sunday morning. And he said they invited some young pastor, and he spoke for 45 minutes. And Adams said, "What can you possibly learn of importance in 45 minutes?" So I'm nostalgic. I'm nostalgic for those old days. This isn't a pre-warning. I'm just saying I'm nostalgic for those days. But you know, it's not as hard to understand Revelation as I think we often assume if you simply read it as a chronologically ordered book and you take it literally, except where it obviously offers interpretations of the symbol so you can recognize what they're speaking about, that you can begin to see that it has one very clear, important, and central message that we desperately need to hear. In fact, he tells us that when we read it, there's a blessing that God bestows upon us. And the message is really simple. It's foretelling us that there's a final and ultimate future for earth and mankind. As he says in the beginning of chapter 4 to John, he says, "I will show you what must take place after this." So it isn't like he's just kind of throwing out some kind of crazy symbolisms like you would read in a book like Nostradamus or The Rancher or different books like that that have all these kind of mystical symbols that you can interpret and apply to just about anything or anyone at any time that you might choose to. This is very simple. He said, these are things that are going to literally take place. They must take place. In the same way that when Jesus was told to tell his disciples to stop proclaiming him the Messiah on his descent down the Palm Sunday road, he said to the Pharisees, if they didn't cry out, the very stones would cry out. This has to happen. And so I think it's so important that when we begin reading a book like Revelation, where he speaks of the future, things that will come, he says, you have to understand, this is not saying this could happen. This literally is going to happen. It is foreordained. It is fixed. We don't know the time. We don't know the date. We don't know the hour, but we know that it is fixed and that it will come to place. That what the Revelation does is clearly underlines the fact that this world is doomed. Hello. that our hope must never be in this world, nor should we trust in its promises of prosperity or longevity. We shouldn't look to its politics, its philosophies, its ideologies. They will all fail. They'll all pass away when Christ comes and sets up his millennial kingdom on the earth. It is, in fact, telling us that it is Christ alone who someday will return, and only then will the mess this world is in be fixed by him creating, as he says later on in chapter 21, a new heaven and a new earth, where God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, and neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away. The longer I live, the more sorrow I experience in life, the more I yearn for this order of things to pass away. But until they do, it's going to continue like this, except, he said, it'll get worse and worse. Before it gets better, he said, that there will come a time in Matthew 24 of great tribulation, unequaled from the beginning of the world until now, never to be equal again. We deal with the word tribulation as if it's a noun, but actually it's a verb. It talks about a time of incredible sorrow, distress, pain, discomfort, displacement, injustice, cruelty, to be troubled, to be in tribulation, to experience the thing, this word called phlipsis. I know, easy for you to say, right? But you go through this, he says it's a time, but he adds this pronoun. He says, but it'll be a megathlipsis. It'll be a time that's so intense and so terrible that he goes on to warn us. The last days, he said, will be perilous times of great stress and troubles, hard to deal with, hard to bear, dangerous, grievous, harsh, fierce, vicious, and savage. And while evil men and imposters will go from bad to worse, deceiving and being deceived. You see, something that is oft overlooked in our teaching today on the scriptures is that we often see God's blessing, we see his mercy, but we overlook the fact that his mercy and his blessing are always preceded by his judgment. And judgment doesn't necessarily mean that God is, it's not synonymous with punishment. Judgment is simply God's declaration of your guilt. Paul even said regarding the Christian life that we as Christians should really rather daily judge ourselves to see whether or not we're walking in the truth. And the way we do it is we hold up God's word and we look at our life in the light of his word and we're saying, am I pursuing the truth of God as it's outlined in scripture, or have I gone off in my own direction? Have I developed my own quasi-Christian ideology where I use the name Jesus and talk a lot about loving but never really address the root cause of everything that's wrong in the world, not just sin, but my sin? When G.K. Chesterton was answered the question, in fact, he wrote an entire book on this topic. He was asked, what's wrong with the world? And his answer was very simple, I am. I am. And it's the I am multiplied 8 billion times around the planet that's wrong with the world, because not only is there a fallen world that's been subject to the victimization of sin, but it has been incorporated in the lives of people like you and me who are sinners, that our only hope is to be saved by his grace. And I say all this not just simply because I want to make you uncomfortable. I say this because this is central. That Paul said we must now judge ourselves with the world, lest we be judged with the world. We need to look at ourselves and say, God, I'm a sinner. And the only way I'm getting to heaven is your grace, your forgiveness. And there's nothing in this world that can be fixed until it's replaced with something that is perfect and filled with people who have been given a new body and are freed from sin and death. Well, what we read here in the beginning, what Simon read to us in the text, is the beginning really events of what we call the tribulation. And the tribulation really is divided into two parts. It's 2 3.5-year sections, each lasting a total of 7 years. The first 3.5 years we call the tribulation. The last 3.5 years we call the Great Tribulation. And the reason is because after that halfway point, things get really dark and ugly upon the planet Earth. Worse than even the description he gives us. But it opens with Jesus being the only one who is worthy to open the seven seals. And as he opens, he breaks each of those seals. A seal was usually a doppel of clay that was or wax that was put on the edge of a scroll document. And it had the seal of the owner on it. And only the one who owned it could open it. Only the one who had the authority was able to break that seal and open it up and see what was on the inside. And so the pictures of seven sealed documents, seven sealed scrolls. And on those scrolls are written the judgments of God against the sins of mankind, and not simply so he can destroy mankind, but by bringing judgment, they would be sorrowed to repentance and be saved. And they looked through heaven and said, who is worthy to open the seals? And only Jesus was found, and so he began to open the seals. And we have what we call the four horsemen of the apocalypse, the first four seals that are opened. And quite honestly, if you consider them with any carefulness, you discover very quickly that they talk about unprecedented levels of cataclysmic destruction. They're horrific to contemplate. First, it speaks of a white horse. And the symbolism really has a parallel to when Zechariah talked about the four horsemen from the four section or four chariot riders coming in the four sections of the world, almost coming from every direction in the world. He says, suddenly these horsemen, these chariots appear, and the first is riding a white horse. Always in the Roman world, a symbol of conquest. Who sat on it and a bow, which was, again, a symbol of warfare, and a crown. And he was wearing a crown, and he went out conquering and to conquer. Now, it's interesting in the words sometimes, because the word crown here is a particular word. It's called Stephanos, where we get our word Stephen. The usual word for a king is he's wearing a diadem. But Stephanos means somebody who has become a king by overcoming others. He's conquered. And so the picture is reiterating really this concept. The figure that it shows, the horse he's riding on, the bow in his hand, the crown on his head, all speak of someone who is going to introduce warfare, conflict, in an effort to conquer and to control in any way and any means possible. So that many interpreters believe that this is talking about the entrance of the beast at the beginning of the tribulation period, where he essentially becomes the most prominent, dominant, most influential world leader. What follows is really a red horse. And with that effect comes peace will be removed from the earth. And it says men will slay one another. In other words, it's going to usher in a time probably as a consequence of the first horse, a time of conflict, a time of violence, division, discord, strife, incredible polarization. Some suggest this will be World War III. We'll have to wait and see a few weeks to see if that's true or not. But then comes a black horse. And honestly, here in verse 6, it's one of the most interesting, fascinating parts of the passage to me, and you'll see why in a bit, where he says, a quart of wheat for a denarius. A denarius was a day's wage for one man. Man went to work, he got a denarius. And what he could do, he said, here he's taking all of his day's wages goes to buy a quart of wheat. Not a lot of wheat. Not enough to feed a family. He says a day's wages for 3 quarts of barley, which is a less expensive grain in the ancient world. I think it still is today. But then in contrast, he says, do not damage the oil and the wine. It's interesting because it's a portrait really of a contrast of famine on one hand and plenty on the other. In fact, William Barclay put it this way. He says, this is a picture of famine set alongside luxury. The luxury of the few at the expense of the many. So essentially, there's going to be this incredible polarization. There's going to be this small elite group who have all the money, all the power, all the authority, all of the control, and then there's everybody else. And then fourthly, he talks about a pale horse who, and the one who sat on him had a name. His name was Death. That's what I call a bummer of a last name, right? You never get invited to the party. His name is Death. And basically, it's a Greek word, Thanatos, just means death. Nothing too complex there. And Hades, which is often confused, but in the context, Hades, we translated hell many times, but it simply meant, in the most general sense, the grave. In other words, what he leaves in his trail are not things that you can enjoy. What he leaves behind is dead bodies that are being buried. The idea that there are masses of bodies to be buried, and we see why in a few moments. Because he says, a fourth of the earth to kill with the sword through famine, plague, and wild beasts of the earth. That it might very simply say that there's going to be so much violence that it will lead to food shortages. And that's usually what happens. We often don't understand that when violence breaks out, for example, when we see the war going on in Ukraine, that Ukraine produces almost all of the wheat that is consumed in Europe and many other parts of the Middle East. That crop's gone. And many other products that come as a result. So it's one of these things that when you think about even how that Russia produces most of the fertilizer for our farmers, where the cost of fertilizer has gone from $230 a ton to now it's up over $900 a ton and keeps on climbing. What that does is it makes it harder to produce crops, but it also makes those crops more expensive. And so people's diets begin to become constricted because they can't afford to pay the ever-increasing prices. But then again, we don't have to worry about that. We haven't seen prices go up that much. That there will come plague, pandemics that will spread, and there will be wild beasts. And that may be literal. It may even be simply that there is such a state of chaos and disorder that it just becomes overrun. It's interesting why people in old days used to kill wild animals, because they weren't comfortable to live with. So you got rid of them. I was talking to one of my elders the other day. We were talking about in our neighborhood, we have turkeys. And I remember 15 years ago, I'm sitting early in the morning, and I'm brushing my teeth, looking out my bathroom window, and I see this string of things walking along, and I thought, what the heck is that? And I realized, those are wild turkeys. How cool. I just found out, he just shared with me, he found out that our own wildlife department planted those stinking, filthy, ugly birds in, and they proliferate like rats. We already have long-legged rats called deers. They eat everything. And now we have these things that they leave behind everything, and they stink. And we're forming a vigilante committee. We're going to go out and take them out. But seriously, Jesus' descriptions of the last days is intended to frighten us. It's meant to disturb us out of a state of complacency or state of apathy, and in a bigger sense, to create in us a healthy fear of God. In Romans 1, Paul complained. He said, the problem is that people don't have a fear of God before their eyes. Now, I've had these arguments with pastors and other people saying, that's the problem. People are afraid of God. And I would say, well, conversely, I would argue that that's the problem. They don't fear God at all. They feel like they can live with impunity. They can do whatever they want, engage in any kind of activity, and God will just look at them like a, you might say, like a cognitive challenged leader who simply would look at them and go, oh, isn't that cute? Oh, you just stop that right now, you little snooker. And it's this kind of idea that people have of God, that he's there, but you know, gosh, he's so old. He doesn't really want to get involved in all that messy stuff. And the Bible tells us he's something quite different, that he is a very clear-minded and sometimes very severe judge. And that what we need to be looking for from him is mercy. But you can only cry for mercy when you're willing to admit you need it. A call for mercy, God, is an admission of our guilt before God. That's why Paul would write to the Corinthians and say, these things were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. And then, as one translator adds in the next verse, do not be so naive and self-confident. You're not exempt. In Luke, Jesus simply said, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? Of course, war and conquest, violence, genocide, poverty, famine, disease, and death have always been a part of the human existence. And yet it's interesting because when you look at the last 5,000 years of human history, the calculations are that there's been 150 million people who have died over the last 5,000 years through war or conflict. But in the 20th century, the lowest number I found was in the 20th century, there were at least 104 million people who perished. It was the bloodiest, deadliest century in human history. And the fear is that we're trying to catch up. When we look at the fact that there's 576 different armed militias in the world in 64 different countries, that's almost a third of the countries on the planet have some kind of armed insurrection going on. That it's not simply limited to the Ukraine or Syria or Afghanistan or Sudan or Yemen and Ethiopia, Libya, Nigeria, or even the Mexican drug war, that northern Mexico has almost virtually been taken over by the cartels, waging wars so that 2 million people can come across our borders every year. In fact, when we look at the entire history of mankind, we could find only 8% of the time where there wasn't a war that involved most of the people on the planet. So that the chances of people being in conflict and going to war is much higher. And interestingly, the first thing we read about after Adam and Eve transgressed and introduced sin into human history was that the older brother murders his younger brother. It's something that is much more common than we would ever like to admit and certainly don't want to believe. But Jesus said, therefore, that the last times would be even worse. In fact, the word he used was dreadful, which if you look in the original language, it translates dreadful. He said, there will be great distress. And this is a key word, unequaled from the beginning of the world until now, and never to be equaled again. He adds, if those days had not been cut short, no one would survive, but for the sake of the elect, those days will be shortened. It's so bad that the Lord told John that 1/4 of the population of the earth will die. If that were today, we're talking about somewhere close to 2 billion people would perish. Those are problems that are hard to get our, the numbers that are hard for us to conceptualize, 2 billion. A book I read years ago about the genocides in Ukraine, first by the Soviets and then followed by the Nazis and then again reintroduced by the Soviets once again, that within that few 20, 30 year period, 16 million Ukrainians died because of the Germans and the Soviets. And it was interesting because the writer said it's such a large number, so difficult to get your mind around, you have to think of it this way. It's one person dying 16 million times over and over and over and over again. You see, those, they're abstractions to us. And so because they're abstractions, it's hard for us to, we may take it literally, but do we take it seriously? And this is my great rub because we have lots of people who profess to be Christians who do not take the Bible literally and kind of pick and choose the parts that they like and leave out the ones they don't. They're like a 5-year-old looking at his plate and choosing what he will eat and not eat. If it's green, you don't touch it, right? And that's how they approach in their immaturity of faith. They just kind of pick and choose the parts of the Bible that they like and put aside the ones they don't want and wait for dessert, which is heaven. And that's a major problem in Christianity in this culture today. But there are a lot of other people, I think people like us, we say, well, I take the Bible literally, But I have a second question to follow up with that. How seriously do you take it? It's one thing to say, I see what it says, and I'm really trying to emphasize this because what he describes here is so horrific that the mind can hardly get its brain around it and say, how in the world could something like this happen? Therefore, I'll deal with it the way I deal with most big problems in my life. I just won't think about it and hope it goes away. That the aftermath of all these things he's saying is that there will be famine and there will be disease and there will be savagery. And yet at the same time, those who have great power and wealth will survive. It's almost a return to a medieval world where the feudal system of the lord of the manor who ruled over all the serfs and the slaves. He describes a period of international chaos. And it's in this time that Revelation tells us that there will be a leader who will stand up on the world scene. And as Paul said in 1 Thessalonians 5:3, he'll say to them, I am the answer. I will bring peace and safety upon the planet. I will solve all these great perplexing problems that Jesus said will be causing men's heart to fail them for fear. And according to the prophet Daniel, he will plant his capital in the world's only international city, Jerusalem. And he will build a coalition with the Israelites, with the Jews, and he'll rebuild the temple after the great defeat of the Islamic armies. And he will institute a universal monetary system that without it, he said, no one would be able to buy or sell unless he had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of his name. Adam Smith, who was the father of modern economic theory, lived back in the 1700s, but pretty much he laid out the groundwork for how a free market capitalist system could work and what it needed to do. I wish we paid more attention to it. But he had a number of really insightful statements, and one of them was, he says, money is whatever you believe it to be. And we have grown up looking at these bills with founding fathers on them, and we would look at that as money, as cash, as currency. And it's an amazing thing, you know, it carries a lot of cachet with it regardless of where you go in the world. That's an amazing thing. You know, you pull out a $100 bill just about any place on the planet and people are willing to do business with you, whether it's illegal or not, they're willing to do it because it's perceived value. And so it's inconceivable to us that we would come into a system where what we perceive as value and have always perceived as value suddenly has no value, even though it's in the process of that at this very moment. So when they tell you that we've had a 7.9% inflation rate over the last year, let's round it off to 8%, that means that your $100 is now $92. Not just theoretically, but that's literally what it is. But here's the interesting thing. In 1990, they changed the CPI, which is consumer price indexed. In other words, up ever since 1884, they've created the CPI. What does it cost the average person to live? I mean, how much does it cost for expenses so they could begin to track this thing called inflation? And they did that all the way up until 1990, and then they began to realize the inflation rate is so high that we're going to have to raise everybody's Social Security payments and all these government workers. It's going to cost us a fortune. So let's come up with a new formula. And you know what they did? They changed what they measured the inflation rate by so that they were able to reduce the inflation rate by 50%. Now, I'm sure it was just an oversight. But most people who are looking at it saying the actual inflation rate we're dealing with right now today in America is 15% a year. And it doesn't have any signs of slowing up. But this is where it's interesting because one of the key things that we often get focused on, because it all in a way begins with economics, doesn't it? It all starts with money. That beginning last year, they had to do it in two parts, the end of last year and the beginning of this year. The Biden administration made a donation of $1 trillion into the International Monetary Fund to expand their new monetary policy, which many people are saying is the beginning of a whole new international monetary system. You see, the problem with the IMF is that a lot of countries are too poor to be able to get money from the IMF. So we're giving them an extra $1 trillion so all 190 nations around the world now can have a certain amount of currency that's given to them. The United States essentially is giving them a piece of the pie and saying, now if you want to buy vaccines or infrastructure and stuff, you can draw from this fund and help the world around that. I mean, it's a very generous thing. I don't know that anybody ever voted for it, but you know, basically it was a very generous thing in giving away other people's money so freely. But you see, as one article put it very simply, the process of adopting a new global currency along with a global central bank to administer that currency for the purpose of replacing the US dollar and all other national currencies. So take, for example, say you're traveling in another country and you put your credit card in the slot to pay for something in pesos or euros or whatever it is. It's a, you know, you put it in there and you buy it. And what happens is they have based the value of your dollar on what they call a market basket of currencies. So you have the euro, the dollar, you have the yen, the renminbi, the yuan of the Chinese, and you have the, who's the fourth one? The mark? The German? Well, no, that wouldn't be the mark. Anyway, so you have five currencies that are in this basket. And they take the average of those, and that's what your bill is worth. But the problem is, the dollar is dropping significantly in value, and it's throwing the whole thing off. And it's really due to very one simple thing. There's a growing instability in the U.S. economy. Now, there's a guy named Ray Dalio. He just wrote a book. He's a hedge fund guy, you know, one of the biggest hedge funds he runs in the world. And he was basically wrote this book for people who are investing their monies to say, how do you keep your money growing in an ever-changing world market? I mean, this was his big concern and what he speaks to in his newest book. And he made the observation, the reason why he wrote this is because huge debt, super low interest rates, catalyzing the printing of enormous amounts of world reserve currency, basically US dollars, has devalued and destabilized the US dollar and signals that the US dollar might not be the world's reserve currency much longer. Now, we know the Federal Reserve Bank, it's kind of an interesting structure. They have the right to print money. And their job is to kind of keep the economy balanced by giving money or making money more expensive. They can speed up the economy, slow down the economy. That's their job. They have 12 members of national and international banks. It's owned by, it's not a government organization. It's called the Federal Reserve Board, but it's not part of the federal government. It's independent. It's owned by the banks that are part of it. But they have the power to be the kind of like the central bank who produces currency. And then they have another 24 banks that they can give money to in the world. And you see, you want to be on good terms if you're a banker in, say, Germany, because if you get on the bad side of them, for example, one of the newest things they're working on right now, if you are investing in things that cause too large a carbon footprint, say, for example, oil, well, they would simply say, that is not a valid loan, so therefore we're not going to give you this much money. And they began to shrink the reserves of the banks, and that's how they make their money, by loaning it out. Well, basically, how much did they give out last year? $150 trillion. We get caught up in the deficit. $150 trillion. Was put out. But what does that do? Well, it stimulates the economy for a while, but pretty soon people saying, you're making more money, I want to get paid more money. And because I'm getting paid more money, it's going to cost more money for people to buy the product you made. And it goes through the cycle. So basically that's what causes inflation. As more money comes into the market, the cost of doing things goes up. And that's why the Fed's job is to raise interest rates. And when it hits 2% inflation per year, they're supposed to raise the interest rates. They haven't done that since COVID. You see, when the former president left office, the inflation rate was at 1.7%. And today we're at realistically 15%, because we flood so much money. And we're fortunate in a way because the Senate didn't endorse the Build Back Better plan, which would have injected $5.6 trillion more. You know, I can't even keep count. So you ask a question. So how are we doing? Where is this country at right at this point? And I have really a series of charts I hope we can bring up here if you can see them. One is called the U.S. debt clock. And you can go online and look it up, and it changes constantly. It's constantly running. But what it really points out is that right now the U.S. is running an initial debt of $30 trillion. Now, our annual income is $4 trillion in taxes that you pay. That means that, and our gross domestic product that we produce is $24 trillion. So for a country to be in good shape, you want the blue number, 24, to be bigger than the red one on the top. In other words, if your debt ratio is going up and your income is not going up as fast, we call that a bad thing. You know, you're spending more than you have. But you see, we have a lot of people in government, in our leadership, who grew up under the philosophy, if you still have checks, you still have money. So, or as my kids used to say, why don't you just use that plastic thing? The reality is, though, when you take that $30 trillion in debt and you put it out over the life of the loan, in other words, it's collecting interest every month, the actual payoff is $164 trillion. Go to the next one if you want. So if you look at the U.S. budget, and it's a fascinating thing because we often talk, say, we need to cut government spending. Well, look at some of the figures that here on this chart. You have 24% of the federal budget, 24%. You know, one out of every $4 goes to pay for Medicare. And the idea is, let's expand Medicare so everybody's on Medicare. Great idea, but do you have any idea what that does to the costs? And then you look around it, you look at things like Social Security, it's another quarter of the diet. So 50% of our budget is just Medicare, Social Security, and disability, and things that go with that. And then you start going around, you say, there are other mandatory things, things that we're required to pay for, all sorts of things. They add up to another 13, 14%. The interest alone is 7.8%. 8% interest that we're paying on the money we're borrowing. So when you say we want them to cut government spending, if the government didn't do anything else but these basic things, we would reduce the budget by 15%. So again, you look, if an income of $4 trillion, have expenses of $7 trillion, you have a deficit of $3 trillion every year. And again, long term, that's $164 trillion in debt. But let's put it down to the per person expense, because don't let anybody lie to you. Taxpayers pay debt for the government. And it comes to $500,000 per person that you owe right now. So before you leave, I want you to be sure and settle your debt. Now, another chart, I'm just going to keep on beating with you until you crawl out of here in pain. the next chart... If you look at the federal deficit again, approaching it from a little different, in 2020, our federal deficit was $3.1 trillion. In other words, when the current administration came into power, the budget that they handed to them by the prior administration was $3 trillion more than the income that was coming in. 2021, the economy began to improve, and it was only $2.3 trillion. But the 2022 projected, removing the Build Back Better plan, is still another $1.5 trillion, so that what we've added in the last few years is almost another $7 trillion to the federal deficit. Now, Ray Dalio called this the big cycle. The big cycle, he said. And it's interesting because he said there's a series of things that begin to accumulate. First of all, he said, you begin with so much debt that the value of the dollar begins to deteriorate. But he said, but what also follows is internal disorder. Now he's talking about things, he says, five things that bring a great nation to its knees. five things that happen. He says, when those five things happen all at the same time, your country is going to be diminished. It's going to be diminished in terms of its importance, its influence, even its ability to affect the world around us. Internal disorder, talks about, he said, it's fissures that take place in the value systems, in the wealth. You find the diversity between the rich and the poor gets greater. Right now, we have the highest gap between rich and poor than we've had in the last 100 years of our history. The rich are getting obscenely rich, and the rest of us are losing ground steadily. They said there'll be a splits in politics that are exasperated by the economic instability. He says people begin caring more about the success of their causes over the continuation of the system. The system's position becomes precarious. So that when you find things like critical race theory, Black Lives Matter, any number of these kind of causes that are kind of rattling and rumbling through the culture, he says what that does is it causes a polarization, a splitting, a dividing, that people become so committed to seeing their cause triumph, they don't even recognize the cost to the greater whole. The countries hold together by cooperation and consensus. They're more concerned about the success of their cause than they are of the continuation of the system. And the system's position becomes precarious. He said, in the United States, the chance of civil war in the next 10 years is about 30%. The third thing he said is external disorder, the rise of global rivals. He says you begin to see other nations banding together to bring down the big guy. So when we look at what's happening right now and today, amazingly, that Russia and China, which our political policy had been for decades to divide those two, and now they are coming together again, and we put sanctions on Russia, but already China has prepaid for all of the oil and all of the coal and all of the wheat that Russia can produce. So we can't sanction it because they've already paid for it. So it'll be a long time before sanctions ever really have an impact on anybody else than the average Russian citizen who will ultimately bear the hardship. But we know that China has now become our chief rival in the world. They've said it very clearly. they plan to overtake us and to make us subservient to their will. Fourthly, he said there will be natural disasters, things like plagues, famines, and floods. You know, hurricanes, tornadoes, those kind of things happen, and we always have FEMA funds that go to help them. What are FEMA funds? They're tax dollars that have been set aside to help in emergency situations. Great program, good idea, but the fact is, when those things begin to happen on too often and frequent a pace, you find it more and more difficult, and the cost of replacement becomes more difficult. The cost of treating disasters right now in the world has gone up exponentially for one simple reason. We've expanded our homes into areas that people used to know you shouldn't build there. But the view is crazy. Well, there's a 100-year flood that comes every 2 years. And then finally, technological innovations that change the world. I don't know if you follow it closely at all, but the big concern in the U.S. right now is that China is outpacing the United States in 5G technology. And what's the thing with 5G technology? It runs everything better and faster. It's more ubiquitous. It becomes something in everything. My kids got me a pair of sneakers for, I think, Christmas, my birthday. Yeah, it was my birthday. And I was reading the brochure on them because my kids tell me they're really hip and they're really cool. So, okay. And I find out it has a chip in the shoe so that you can verify its authenticity until you want to trade it or sell it. And I thought to myself, next time I go to the airport, I'm not wearing those shoes. But I mean, you begin to realize that everything is chipped. But who can access it the most quickly? And I haven't even touched on the issue of cyber warfare, which we're also losing at and falling behind. That's simply the greatest fear. It was just last month, a little more than 4 weeks ago, the Israeli government sponsored an international conference. They invited 10 nations, funny number, I don't know how to come up with 10, as well as the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the Bank of International Settlement. They're the ones who handle all the transitions around the world. For a plan how to respond when Russia and China launch cyber warfare on the U.S. economy. How are we going to deal with that? How are we going to defend against that? We already know last week there was 6 separate attacks by the Chinese against our financial systems and many of our state governments. It's a constant ongoing thing. I had one guy whose job is basically chasing these things down and trying to stop them. He said, there are so many, they're coming so fast, there's no way we can keep up with it. They're just overloading us. Technological innovation means the ability to shut down your systems so they no longer function. So as at the same time that every government in the world is moving into a digital currency, every one major country in the world is moving. If you read the articles, you see they're going there. They're going to a digital currency. It's happening. It's coming. As they're doing that, they're also looking at the fact that we now have this incredible vulnerability. And I know you're saying, well, what about cryptocurrency? Well, your president has just sponsored a new bill to bring that under government control as well. Now, Dalio said this, and he says, at a conceptual level, people understand that the sun eventually sets on any state or economy, on a conceptual level, but most are still shocked when the sun sets on theirs. An empire's average lifespan is about 250 years, which is how old the United States is. And the demise of those nations takes 5 years. In 5 years, they go from being strong to being broken. 5 years. In light of what I've seen happen in the last year, I'm not surprised. 4 years from now, we'll understand more clearly what it means to live by faith. As the old saying goes, follow the money. Solomon said in Ecclesiastes 10, money is the answer for everything. Because even though I often in these series of messages talk about one world government, one world economy, and one world religion, they all are interrelated and they most of all depend upon money. I mean, you don't have a government without money, and most religions don't last very long without money. So basically, follow the money. James Bullard, who now is currently the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, one of the 12, said, interestingly, in a recent interview, he said, rampant price inflation could metastasize into a severe issue that could prove challenging to resolve. We're at more risk now than we've been in a generation that this could get out of control if a new surprise that hits us that we can't anticipate right now, and we would have even more inflation, literally hyperinflation. That's the kind of situation we want to make sure it doesn't occur. And then the war in Ukraine broke out, followed by the reactions, the sanctions, and so forth and so on. That's the kind of thing he said, this could just drive inflation. And as we see, it's just added to the problem. So I would say, so what you're saying, Mr. Ballard, is that things like Ukraine or Taiwan or skyrocketing oil prices or the replacement of the dollar's reserve currency. In fact, Adam Smith, who I mentioned before, the initial modern economist, had one saying that he was so pithy. He said, there's a lot of ruin in a nation. What he meant by ruin is a nation can make a lot of bad decisions. They can get involved in a lot of bad things that cost them. There's a lot of ruins in a nation. There's not, though, an unlimited amount of ruin. In other words, it's not one bad decision. It's a series of bad decisions after another. And they start compounding when you stay the course, when it's clear the course is going off the edge. And the person sitting next to you keeps on calling you Thelma. You know, that's, you say, stay the course. So, I mean, I would just simply, it would be something kind of crazy like delighting in the midst of the Ukrainian war to be so excited over electric-powered cars that we don't have, we can't afford, and we couldn't power them if we did. And you realize that if climate change is the most frightening thing, wouldn't most of us agree there's some other issues that are kind of more front burner issues than that, even if you believe that's true? This is why verse 6 has always stood out for me when he said, a quart of wheat for a day's wages, but do not damage the oil and the wine. He said there'll be this kind of excessive medieval income inequality. The financial elites who run the world and are immune really to the effects of inflation because their monies are usually tied up in assets that go up in value, not things that will lose value. There's a bigger gap that begins to grow. For those in my generation who bought our houses 30 years ago and we paid them off and they were cheap when we bought them and now they're worth a ridiculous amount of money, it's not a big problem. But for the young couple who wants to buy their first home, suddenly it's becoming more and more a problem. This creates social problems. This creates conflicts. This creates envy and division and strife and hatred. So that when we try to look at even like the millennial generation, the Zers, who really I like the idea of socialism, it's because, as Bob Dylan once said so prophetically, if you ain't got nothing, you ain't got nothing to lose. And many of them think the only way I'll ever get something is if the government takes everything and redistributes the wealth. It's not a faulty logic, but the problem is that when government redistributes the wealth, they always take a big share for themselves first. And they usually reward the people they like and who agree with them and support toward their policies. They're immune to inflation. They're immune to unemployment. They're immune to the collapse of a bank or a country. They can see it coming before it even gets here. They know what's going on. They sit in those committees in the Senate and in the House, and as soon as they hear the rumors of potential war, they're investing in military stocks. They put it in some kind of safe harbor, maybe in a Panama account offshore. Or even as the IMF is now opening up personal, private banking accounts that people can invest from all over the world, that no longer is subject to the inflation of the dollar or any other currency. It's a fixed value that they set, and everybody has to do business based upon that. So what am I doing? I'm armed to the teeth. I am, but that's not what I'm doing. No, seriously, I'm praying for the rapture. And I have people saying, well, I don't know, you're just afraid to go through the tribulation. And I said, exactly. Exactly. I have no interest in being through going through what I see described here. Obviously, you haven't read it in a while. But in the meantime, I always come back to the things that Jesus simply said in Matthew 6 when he wrote, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth. Store up for yourselves treasures in heaven. For where your treasure is, he says, there your heart will be also. Do not worry. Do not worry about your life, but seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. The other day, went into the parking lot at Yokes, opened my car door, and a gust of wind just ripped the door out of my hand and slammed it up against another car. I said, oh dear, look at the dent I put in that car. Let's drive away. No, I got a conscience towards God. So I got up and I looked at it, and my door actually got the worst of it. But I went around and told him, here's my information, so forth. Unforeseen consequences. But I was reminded in that moment something my pastor used to always say to me every time he got a scratch on the side of his car. He'd say, you know, it's all going to burn. It's all going to burn. And I thought, yeah, true. It's all temporary. And this becomes really the issue. Why does he tell us about these scary things? In a way, like the old saying says, we get scared straight. That we realize that, yes, The love of God is attractive, especially if you've never known true love. But you have to understand the judgment of God is also a reality that's coming, and it's going to affect the world. This is not something that might happen. This eventually is going to happen exactly as he says it's going to happen. And we need to make sure that we're putting our treasure in heaven, that we're not living in fear and worry, but we're living in the hope and the anticipation when Christ will fix this world. Father God, I pray that you would just give us hearts that could align truly with you. That it's normal for us to be afraid of circumstances. For me, sometimes I just sit and I'm looking at all these things going on, and I just, you can't imagine that people can be so blind. But then I remember that before I knew Jesus, I was blind as a bat. Lord, it's only you who gives us wisdom. It's only you who directs our path. It's only you who helps us to make the right and the good decisions. It's only you, Lord, who tells us what we should commit our life to that will have eternal value and not just temporary advantage. I pray you, Lord, you'd grant us that discernment in Jesus' holy name. Amen.